On today's episode of Rak Höger, I'm speaking with Yasha Monk, who is a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations and an international affairs professor at Johns Hopkins University. On today's episode of Rak Höger, I'm speaking with Yasha Monk, who is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and an international affairs professor at Johns Hopkins University. He also hosts his own podcast called The Good Fight, where I first found out about him. He's written a bunch of books, and his latest, The Identity Trap, just came out. And it's about diversity, equity, and inclusion, abbreviated as DEI, the woke ideology, and identity politics. And of course, these concepts and terms are often used interchangeably, but instead of using them because they are so politically contested and fraught, Monk opts to use the term the identity synthesis instead. And he traces the ideas back to the works of scholars like Derek Bell, Michel Foucault, and Kimberly Crenshaw, highlighting how their ideas have been simplified, twisted, and or radicalized in popular discourse and institutional policies. Monk argues that while these theories have provided valuable insights into the complexities of identity and oppression, their current application often undermines social cohesion, free speech, and the pursuit of equality by promoting division, silencing dissent, and prioritizing identity over shared humanity. Monk also argues that the left's long march through the institutions that's often referred to actually was much shorter than believed. The takeover was swift, he claims, and therefore we should perhaps not focus so much on the 60s. He's also concerned with the backlash from the right and recently had an interesting debate with Chris Rufo on Barry Weiss's podcast, Honestly. Rufo, Monk says, is fighting fire with fire, and that will, well, backfire. Laws and regulations won't increase freedom, he says, and it won't stop ideas from spreading. So that's what the conversation today is about. Now for today's guest, you're listening to Rak Höger with me, Ivar Arpi. Welcome, Yasha Monk, to Rak Höger.
Thank you very much. I look forward to the conversation.
Yeah, and I've been following you for quite some time, and listening to your podcast and reading your books. But your latest book, The Identity Trap, a story of ideas and power in our time, It catered to my interests a lot because I've been writing on these issues, but it's a very, very interesting read. But I just wanted to ask, like, the journalist question: why did you write this book?
Well, look, I'm from the left and off the left. I joined the youth organization of the German Social Democratic Party when I was 13 years old. But for me, what appealed to me about that version of the left was its humanism and its universalism. I took it then that it was this political direction that said, you know, we can communicate across boundaries of race and gender and sexual orientation and religion and ethnic origin, that we are able to be in conversation with each other and learn from each other. And that is one of the positive things about contemporary societies. But we want to create a world in which the way we treat each other and the way the state treats all of us comes to be less dependent on the groups into which we're born. And I have seen over the course of the last decades in academic circles and activist circles, over the course of the last 10 years in terms of a public debate and public policy, the left give up on many of those ideals to start to say, if you stand at a different intersection of identities to me, then I might not really be able to understand you at all. That if I'm inspired by your culture, particularly if you come from a minority group. That's not a positive thing about life in Stockholm or Berlin or London or New York today. It's something to worry about under the heading of cultural appropriation. I'm committing some kind of injustice. And that the way we should treat each other should come to be more and more dependent on the identity groups on which we are a part. I should be hyper-conscious of the fact that you're a member of some identity group when I talk to you. And even the way that the state decides in public policy, even in some cases like in the United States, when it comes to, you know, life and death decisions, like who should be prioritized for vaccines for COVID, you know, what groups people are part of, what their skin color is, what their identity is, should be a determinative factor. That goes against the longstanding values that I've held. It's a fascinating intellectual development, the rise of a genuinely new ideology in our public discourse. And so I wanted to write a book that explains where these ideas come from, how they could become so influential so quickly, why they ultimately are leading us in the wrong direction, and what to do about it, how to fight back.
And coming from the left is maybe... nowadays, you sound like, I would say, if you just like, if you just took an alien and dropped them down and heard you speak about this, they would probably put you in the corner of being right wing. I mean, I'm not saying that you are, but that's like a lot of the criticism against what you in the book call, I'm gonna try to pronounce this as best as Swede can, but the identity synthesis. And that is a word you choose because identity politics or woke are laden with a lot of political conflict. So you chose another way to label it. But the criticism has often come from the right in the last two decades. So should you? Still call yourself left then if you are not representative of the new left, or how do you view that?
Well, one of the mechanisms by which this ideology has become so influential is that its most ardent adherents like to denounce everybody who disagrees with them by the use of bad terms, right? So if you don't agree with their understanding of what equity is, their understanding of what anti-racism is, they're going to say you're a bigot, you're a racist, you're a sexist, and so on and so forth. And when you are, broadly speaking, on the left, when you're a member of certain kinds of mainstream institutions, the fear of being called by those names is extremely strong and present. And so a lot of left-wing people who are quite critical of these ideas have, frankly, lacked the courage to speak out against them. I think if you're on the political right, it is... easier to do so because it is not your friends calling you these bad names. And, you know, being beaten up on by the political enemy, by the person on the other side of the political spectrum, is actually a proof that you're provoking the right people, that you're doing the right thing, right? But I think as a result, we've slightly artificially suppressed how much dislike there is in many parts of the left about these ideas. I'm very worried about how quickly these ideas have become incredibly influential in society. And I think that there's going to be a generational fight over these ideas, that the contestation over the identity synthesis is going to take up the next 25 years of public debate in significant ways. But I also think that we should take comfort from the fact that there's a very broad variety of political and religious traditions that should reject this identitarian thinking. You know, this is true of, you know, Buddhists who should think that the most important thing about us is not the kind of earthly station we are born into. It's also true of Christians who think that we're made in the image of God and that our shared human nature, the fact that we share having a soul, is more important than the particular, you know, ethnic or religious or certainly, you know, sexual group that we're born into. And I would say the same is even true in politics. You know, I think conservatives have good reason to be skeptical of this new form of identity obsession. But so do Marxists, right? I'm not a Marxist, but I quote Marxists in my book who have some of the most trenchant critiques of the idea of equity, of the idea of race disparitarianism. The African-American political thinker Adolf Reed Jr., for example, who says, look, according to those kinds of equity ideas, American society would be just if only about 13% of billionaires were black, because roughly 13% of the American population is black. But that could still be an incredibly unequal society in which the billionaire class has all of the money and everybody else is extremely poor. That doesn't seem like a just society, even if it would satisfy the demands of equity, of what he calls racist proletarianism. Mm. So one of the reasons I'm optimistic about being able to beat this ideology in the long run over the next 25 years is that there's good reasons among the secular and religious, good reasons among people who lean right and among people who lean left to reject it.
And your own background, we spoke a little bit before we started recording, and you have a range of languages that you know how to speak, and you were born in Germany. We were born the same year, and I only know how to speak Swedish, Danish, and English. I think you beat me by a large margin, and especially if you count the number of people who speak the languages. So you have a vantage point, like from a personal level, because of your personal history. You're from Germany, but your first book was about like being because of your Jewish heritage, being not at home in Germany, because Germany hasn't dealt particularly well with its history, you said, and it's very, very abbreviated form of trying to summarize your book. And now you live in the United States, and you also speak French, Italian, and Polish, I think you said. So, I mean, you are basically appropriating a lot of cultures, and I mean, if cultural appropriation is something that you should take seriously, I think you're doing a lot of bad things, because you're but
guilty as charged.
I mean, yeah, and but I mean, like, so if everybody should stick to their culture and their race and their identity, where do you fit in then?
And by the way, one connection you didn't mention, and perhaps you weren't aware of, is that I have a significant family in Sweden. So my family story is that my parents and grandparents were thrown out of communist Poland in 1968 because they were Jews. There was a big anti-Semitic pogrom, state-sponsored at the time, and they sort of scattered to different countries. And my uncle and my grandmother ended up in southern Sweden. So I spent weeks every summer in Lund and Malmö, and other places in Skåne. If you struggle to pronounce identity synthesis, I'm afraid I still struggle to pronounce the few phrases of Swedish I know.
If the phrases were in skånska, in the local dialect, you are basically just like all the other Swedes. We all struggle with that dialect.
For people of your generation, I think younger Swedes may no longer know this phrase, but I have a cousin in Sweden who was sort of a little younger than me and I guess shy at that time, and she enlisted me to help her standing in a department store when I was 11 or 12 years old, shouting "Bingo Lotto för imorgon kväll."
Oh, that's really good. Yeah, I actually sold Bingo Lotto, so I was one of those kids.
And my understanding is that it's kind of social democratic rite of passage, right? That so that the students would, the kids would raise the money for the school trips themselves, so that if the parents didn't have the money, then there wouldn't be a form of unequal treatment or something like that. Is that roughly right?
Yeah, that's right. That's the equality culture I grew up in.
Right. So, to go back to the broader part of your question, yes, so I grew up in Germany being Jewish. I'm not religious. My parents and grandparents weren't religious. So it wasn't a huge part of my identity, but I noticed that when it somehow came up, when people sort of figured out that I was Jewish, it sometimes led to experiences of anti-Semitism, but more often actually it led to experiences of somewhat creepy philo-Semitism, of people sort of going out of a way to treat me especially well on the basis that I'm Jewish. And that was meant as a way of, being contrite about Germany's past, of demonstrating that the good Germans rather than bad Germans. It was full of good intentions, and I have a lot of empathy for people who made those kind of social faux pas, who engaged in those kind of weird forms of behavior. But it always put an enormous amount of distance between me and the people who I was dealing with. It always made me feel that I wasn't a true equal. And I found it harder to deal with even when certain forms of anti-Semitism. And so, you know, I've been struck in the new kind of cultural dispensation that, you know, I moved from Germany to the United States and I sort of transformed from being a representative of a salient victim group of Jews in Germany to a representative of a salient group of perpetrators of whites in the United States. And in some context, it's now expected of me that I treat other people with a kind of demonstrative goodwill and sort of special treatment that was applied to me when I was growing up and that I hated being treated as I was growing up. So I do think that one of the ways in which my identity has shaped some of my views on this is to be very skeptical that we can make progress towards a fairer and more equal society through those kinds of social norms.
I mean, it's very hard to integrate somebody into white guilt if that person is not considered white. I mean, then it's a sort of the white guilt becomes like a privilege that you are, if you're not the powerful one, you're at least we were the powerful ones. So like, but it's very hard to go around like treating people very nice and being like going out of your way all the time. There is no equality like of between human beings there.
Well, and sometimes it actually ends up patronizing people. So there's, I can give you one example based in a study and one example based in personal experience. So the study is that it turns out that when sort of left-leaning Americans speak to predominantly black audiences, they use simpler vocabulary than when right-leaning Americans speak to black audiences. So basically, these left-leaning Americans dumb down how they speak because of their patronizing assumptions about, I don't know, about the cognitive skills or the education level or the, you know, how deprived the average black audience member might be, right? Which I think says something about the very weird culture of a certain corner of progressive America. I can tell you another story from the classroom when I got very upset with my students who are well-meaning, but who I think really actually were acting in an unjust way. I taught a class once at Harvard about writing about politics. So the students, it was a workshop style class. So the students would produce drafts of a political speech, of a sort of, you know, opinion article, and then a sort of more narrative piece of political nonfiction. And, you know, the students were meant to give each other constructive feedback, but robust feedback, right? I mean, part of the point was to learn, and to learn, you have to say, this is not really working in what he submitted. And we had a black woman in the class who was very talented and very nice, who did not in any kind of way indicate that she would be offended if she was criticized or anything like that. There was no social cues that I could pick up from her that sort of signaled, you know, I'm going to be offended if you in any way, you know, criticize me. And when she submitted a draft of a political speech, which was a sort of acceptance speech by a producer of Black Panther for what they should say at the Oscars, which was sort of left-leaning, you know, in content, the students were way too scared to criticize that draft of her speech. It was a good draft. She was a good student. But, you know, like every other piece of writing that had been submitted during the course of the term, there were some, you know, obvious things that could be improved. And the students just didn't want to go there. They did not want to say a critical word about this draft. And I got a little bit angry with them because I said, look, it's a strong draft. I like it. I think there's strong things in it. But she deserves the same pedagogical experience as all of you. Like, you think you're doing her a favor by, you know, being particularly nice and not saying anything that could potentially be negative, but you're not being nice. You're actually depriving her of the same opportunity to improve her writing that all of you had. And I think that's a good example of a way in which that kind of culture, you know, is motivated by some form of guilt or some form of trying to be especially nice, but often isn't particularly nice, often actually treats people worse than they might be. And perhaps I can just add, you know, my friend Coleman Hughes, in his new book, tells the story of his grandfather, which is very interesting, in order to illustrate a key point, which is that we should have an accurate assessment of how much racial discrimination there is. I think there's a lot of people who feel, if you're saying that we've made some progress on matters of race in the last years, they sort of think he's trying to undermine or minimize the problem, because there's no cost to exaggerating the problem, but there's a cost to minimizing the problem. And I think, like Coleman does, that we should be accurate in our perception, because only then can we get to the right remedies. If you believe, like many of the advocates of the identity synthesis, that we haven't made any progress on matters of race over the last 50 years, then a logical inference is, let's rip up the rules of our society because this isn't working. If you think that we have made real progress, imperfect progress, but real progress, then you're much more likely to think, in order to keep doing better, we need to double down on our principles. We need to realize them more completely rather than giving up on them. And so Coleman illustrates very nicely the kinds of costs that exaggerating a problem can have. And it's that his grandfather was an engineer with, I believe, General Electric. I may be getting the company wrong. One of those sort of big 1950s, 1960s all-American companies. And early on in his career, somebody said, look, you know, there's a management track and there's the engineer track, but you should, he was a black man who grew up in the segregated South, you should really focus on the engineer track, because as an engineer, you can kind of advance. As a manager, you know, your white colleagues are not going to want to have a black boss, you know. And this was a very liberal, left-leaning person, right? He meant the advice to be positive. It was rooted in their perception of the injustice of America, and America certainly was an extremely unjust country at the time. But as a result, Coleman's grandfather never really had the ambition to enter management. And finally, 10 years later, he sort of said, well, why don't I give it a try? You know, there's this open position as a manager in my unit or whatever. Why don't I go to, you know, the relevant person and say, you know, would you consider me? And they said, oh, I never, you know, you're excellent. I never thought that you were interested in management. But sure, you know, we'll give you the job. And it turned out that he had a great career and that he didn't experience an unwillingness of, you know, the people who now were working for him to have a black boss. And so Coleman uses this story to illustrate that exaggerating the problem can have real costs, because you're telling people to expect, you know, an extent of hostility and resistance that may, for example, diminish their ambitions. As for a little while, thankfully not for all of his life, it did for Coleman's grandfather.
Yeah, I think what you were with your students, what you were talking about is the racism of low expectations, and that is something many minority students or minority persons have experienced. Like so if you are a high achiever or you want the same, being treated equally and rising as everybody else, and then you're being denied that because we don't expect that from you, but it's well-meaning and it's well-intentioned. But it's the flip side, really, of just like trying to keep people down. But this is like the well-meaning version of it. One thing that I would like to ask that differs sort of from in your book, for example, compared to some of the other books. Because it was like there's been it seems like when a subject is current, there often comes like four or five books on the same subject basically at the same time. And now it was a few years ago, the last time around, so to speak. But in your book, you have I think it's a chapter which is called like the short march through the institutions or something like that, and as compared to the long march through the institutions, that's more often used because it was used by the German far-right activist Rudi Dutschke, who was part of the 60s radical left culture.
Far left activist, yes.
Yeah, far left. But you sort of say that it This isn't the long march. This isn't the Herbert Marcuse, Angela Davis, Rudi Dutschke, and all the local variants in European countries. This is a much shorter time span we are dealing with here.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a little bit of a joke, because, of course, the famous phrase is the long march for the institutions, which Rudi Dutschke explicitly gave out as a kind of strategy for students in the 1960s, originally in a more sort of disruptive way. The idea was like go through the institutions and sabotage them, right? Then in the form that Herbert Marcuse sort of advocated it, it was meant to be a more, you know, gain power through those institutions. And of course, there's many examples in European politics in particular of people who started off as very radical Marxists or Maoists or Trotskyites or various kind of branches of a student movement you had in the 60s. And then, you know, did gain very significant power. There was a moment in the 1990s when, you know, the German government, composed of Gerhard Schröder and as the head of the Social Democrats and the Chancellor, and Joschka Fischer as the Vice Chancellor and Foreign Secretary, the head of the Green Party, had both, you know, come from that kind of milieu. But of course, by the time that 30 years later they were in high power and political office, they had shed many of their original convictions. And so the long march of institutions was somewhat ineffective, because it turned out that it was so long that people shed many of their political ideas by the time they would have been able to implement them. Now, I do think that now a lot of this has come to be much faster. And that's in part because some of the most powerful institutions nowadays are run by younger people. You know, tech companies are very, very young enterprises, for example. The average age of people running them, the average age of people who have senior positions of responsibility within them is much, much younger than, you know, the average age of a CEO of a, you know, Fortune 500 company in 1975 or something like that, right? I think it's partially because young people within organizations have much more power over older people, in part because of social media and because of some changes in the legacy media as well. If they accuse somebody senior in the organization of being one of those terrible words, of being racist or sexist or transphobic or whatever.
Deplorable.
deplorable. That is going to have, you know, a big New York Times story the next day and very unpleasant consequences for those people. So they're just much more likely to defer to younger staff members. And then third, I think that actually the set of students who hold these views is probably larger. You know, in the 60s, there was a very radical student scene, but most students weren't all that political. Today, most students aren't that political either. But the extent to which the mainstream campus culture, including that encouraged by campus bureaucrats, has come to consist in the identity synthesis, I think goes beyond the influence that Marxist or Maoist or other ideas ever had in the 1960s.
And how much... how big a problem is this? Because now I'm doing something that I'm always getting criticized for. I ask a question and then I answer it myself. But I just wanted to add a subtitle to the question. It's that my first book was How We All Became Racists. I wrote it together with Adam Schweiman. And when it came out in 2018, I think, a lot of the criticism was that you're right from the left, you're right, but this is not a problem anymore. This has passed. We passed, so to speak. This was woke wasn't a term then, but basically their argument was that we passed peak woke a while ago. You're just like the afterburner. You're just like the... So you're criticizing something that's already happened. And so it's not that you're wrong. It's that you are irrelevant. And then, of course, 2 years later, Black Lives Matter became a huge issue and a huge movement. But I still keep getting that criticism. Like I've been told that when I write about these issues, that don't come around with those issues again. We passed peak woke is now the term that is actually we passed it like 2 years ago or something, and also another metaphor is like the pendulum has swung, so now the pendulum has swung so. Could you just stop writing, arguing, talking about this? It would just go, you're just making it harder when you talk about this. I just wanted to hear how you would react to a criticism like that against your book and against that argument.
You know, I think one of the deepest shows about politics is a British political sitcom from the 1980s and early 1990s called Yes Minister, and later Yes Prime Minister. I recently have a podcast called The Good Fight, which I encourage all of you to listen to, and I recently had the creator of that show on my podcast.
Oh, really? I missed that episode. I listened to your podcast, but I missed that one.
Yeah, so it was Jonathan Lynn. It was really interesting and really fun, and a great personal pleasure for me. But you know, one of it, this show is full of quotes that really explain politics. But one particularly good one from Sir Humphrey Appleby, the permanent secretary of the Ministry of Administrative Affairs, the sort of brilliant but slightly Machiavellian and nihilistic civil servant on the show, is about how the Foreign Office stops Britain from ever taking action internationally. And he says, you know, stage one, when there's some kind of political problem, he says, we say nothing is going to happen. Stage two, we say something may be about to happen, but we should do nothing about it. Stage three, we say maybe we should do something about it, but there's nothing we can do. And then stage four, we say maybe there was something we should have done about it, but it's too late now.
Then we follow the four-stage strategy.
What's that?
In stage one, we say nothing is going to happen.
Stage two, we say something may be going to happen, but we should do nothing about it.
In stage three, we say that maybe we should do something about it, but there's nothing we can do.
In stage four, we say maybe there was something we could have done, but it's too late now.
And I feel like some of these discussions remind me a little bit of that, right? There's a kind of like, there's nothing to see here. There's just a small kind of set of strange anecdotes, and those are really not representative in any kind of way. What are you talking about, right? And then sort of 5 minutes later, it's like, well, okay, perhaps something really was wrong, but come on, you know, like this really isn't what's happening now. I mean, often sort of it comes along with a denial that people ever held certain kinds of positions. I mean, you look at the things that, you know, big corporations, very important world institutions were saying, you know, in the summer of 2020, and the way in which they're really embracing some of the silliest ideas. And in my book, I really try to focus on the smart formulations of the ideology that I still oppose, but I think the smart formulations of it. The people who are most influential in the summer of 2020 were really the stupidest exponents of it. You know, people like Robin DiAngelo and Ibram X. Kendi, who really, I think, just shouldn't be taken seriously in the same way as Derek Bell or Kimberly Crenshaw or Michel Foucault or Edward Said or Gayatri Spivak, the other figures whose influence I explain.
But it can be entertaining to read Ibram X. Kendi and Robin DiAngelo. They are, as you say, not intellectually formidable, but rather the opposite. I mean, some things they write and say are so inconsistent and confused, or so over-the-top radical, that you just have to laugh sometimes. But I mean, the laughter sort of sticks in your throat because, sadly enough, they and others like them have been hugely influential. So even though you might not want to, you have to take them seriously as public figures.
Right, right. No, I agree. But what's striking is sort of that people have this form of amnesia where they say, you know, in the summer of 2020, there was a while when people were saying, you know, destruction of public property or destruction of businesses is not a form of violence because it doesn't involve human beings or something, right? And you know, I recently a very well-known American political commentator said, well, nobody really said this in 2020. I mean, somebody dug out that they had said a version of that in 2020, right? So there's this sort of genuine form of amnesia about what was happening. And I think, you know, when you talk about these topics today, often you get both of those critiques at the same time from different people. So, you know, I've heard people say, what you're talking about doesn't really exist. It's really just a few anecdotes. It's not a real thing. And then, you know, at the same day, I'll have a different interview where somebody says, well, look, perhaps this really was a problem, but, you know, haven't we reached peak wokeness? And now this is no longer an issue. You know, I think it is an ideology that has genuine influence in society, but holds some real amount of power. It doesn't dominate everything. It doesn't dominate everybody. We don't have to exaggerate it. But when there's a bad ideology that is leading us in the wrong direction, the thing to do about it is to argue against it, to explain it and to argue against it. We don't have to become obsessive about it. I certainly don't have any intention of turning myself into a professional warrior against wokeness. One reason why I wrote this book is that I ended up being so annoyed by these things and arguing about it on Twitter to such an extent that I thought, no, that's not what I should do. I should use my intellectual skills to actually make the best case against it, the most thoughtful case against it, the one that's most grounded in research and argument and logic. And then I want to move on. And my next book is...
This almost sounds like an argument I had with my former editor at Svenska Dagbladet. I got embroiled in a lot of Twitter beefs at the time back then, and she told me, like, okay, Ivar, let's do it like this. First, you write the text, you do the research, and you write the text, and you apply yourself. Then you can tweet about it. Shall we say that that's how you do it going forward? And I was like, yeah, okay, sure, I'll do that. Sounds really good. Much, much smarter. But I'm not sure I managed to live up to it, actually. But it is a better way to handle thoughts and arguments running through one's mind. I mean, try to sublimate it into real texts. It's a much better way to do it. And I mean, to write a book than have endless and often fruitless debates on Twitter, I would say.
I think so. And so, you know, anyway, I think, look, it's not the only thing going on in the world. Perhaps not even the most important thing going on in the world, but it's an important thing going on in the world. It has real power and it has real ability to tear our societies apart, to, encourage rather than help overcome a zero-sum conflict between different identity groups. And so we should take that seriously. You know, one of the sort of little moments that I was surprised by in researching my book is that I thought, look, I'm sort of trained as an intellectual historian, but that's part of what I did as an undergraduate and part of my graduate education as well. But I had no desire to write the intellectual history of these ideas. I thought I'll read the intellectual history of these ideas that scholars must have uncovered and written. I learn from that. That's an important basis for my understanding when I write my critique of these ideas. And I set out to do that, and then I discovered that there's been some interesting books on this by people outside of academia, some better than others, but there's not been a serious scholarly treatment of intellectual origin of these ideas by an academic at all. I had to go and do that, and that's part of a book now. But it sort of indicates the way in which, you know, in the right kind of circles, you're allowed to say, well, it's kind of a problem, but, you know, it's not enough of a problem for us to actually do something about it. And so...
I was at like an academic salon, an unofficial seminar put together by a few entrepreneurs to connect public intellectuals, academics, and entrepreneurs. And the debate was about femwashing and pinkwashing, what it is, if it's happening, if it's right or wrong. It's not really important what the subject was, but there was people with different opinions there, people from the right, people from the left, and each person had to stand up and make their case in under 2 minutes and not make a straw man of the opposing viewpoint. I mean, I liked the format. It was a great evening, actually, but that's not the point here. Sorry for rambling. One of the speakers, a prominent academic in Sweden, he stood up and said, like, okay, I agree with the previous speakers, of which I was one, that there is a problem with identity politics in Swedish academic life. If you apply for grants, you have to like cross certain boxes, for example, how you apply gender theory in any way, and like how many women do you have in your project? And he said, oh, this is a problem, I agree. And then in the next sentence, he said, but it's not a problem compared to this other thing. So that's why, even though he basically agreed with the problem, he could just say that it's so minor that if you think this is a problem, you're not seeing the big picture. In this case, in his view, it was capitalism. So it's a rhetorically nice way to say that you care about the wrong things. And in that context, I wanted to ask you if you've gotten that kind of pushback that you should focus on other things since you're from the left.
Look, first of all, I on the left and the sort of political strategy piece, I think there's this sort of really weird instinct where people on the left often say, well, there's a problem. We kind of know there's a problem, But if we acknowledge it, it's going to help over wrong people. You know, the far right is going to profit from us acknowledging and talking about that. And I think that that's wrong substantively. I mean, I have a great luck and privilege, I suppose, to be able to make my living thinking and writing and talking and teaching about ideas. And I think the one responsibility that comes with that is to say things that I believe to be true and important. That's just my job. And so I don't think I get to chicken out, even if perhaps it's uncomfortable and it makes me enemies or it, you know, makes people be a little less nice to me at the next dinner party I go to. But even in purely strategic terms, I think it's actually a mistake that people in the left and some of the center make, which is that they say, look, there is this kind of problem. It's being exploited by people we don't like. If we give any inch, if we acknowledge it, then it's just going to give them even more power. And I think the opposite is often true. I think people look, you know, even on questions of immigration in a place like Sweden, for example, and they just want to see that moderate political parties, whether on the center-left or the center-right, are going to be willing to say, hey, there are some problems. We understand. We take them seriously. We have a plan for how to deal with them. And then, by the way, perhaps we have a better plan to deal with them than the people on the extremes. I think that makes people feel like they're not crazy, and it makes people feel respected because they're not being sold a bag of goods that is clearly fraudulent. I think what's much worse is when people feel like, oh, so they're like either lying to us or they genuinely have no damn idea, right? And so I think in purely strategic terms, it's usually better to acknowledge a problem and engage with it than to say, but this is not the most important thing, or it's not really a problem, and you know, if only we don't talk about it, nobody's going to know. This is a mistake that journalists often make. They think they can frame how the debate is going to go. You can't frame how the debate is going to go. People aren't idiots, and so you actually have to engage with reality as it is. So it's a strategic and a normative mistake, I think. As to whether I have hope, yes, I do have hope, for the simple reason that societies founded on universal principles, on the principles of philosophical liberalism, have made tremendous progress. That when you look around the world today at the societies that are most rich, most affluent, most tolerant, the societies that people want to immigrate to, the societies that do best in the Human Development Index, they are societies that have historically allowed people collective self-determination, individual freedom, and equal treatment of everybody irrespective of the kind of values they hold, the kind of religion they follow. And so I think these ideals are very powerful. And we have historically been able to make great progress. Sweden today has some genuine problems, some of which are of relatively new vintage. But the society as a whole, I think, is more just, is more prosperous than it was 100 or 50 years ago. And that is because it has made progress in living up to some of these values. And so I reject both the catastrophism of parts of the right that think that we're going to hell in a handbasket and our societies are completely falling apart. I think that's overstating the extent of real problems. And the catastrophism of the left, which says that, you know, as Derek Bell has argued, this has deep intellectual roots in this tradition, that we haven't made any political progress at all, that, you know, America is as racist today as it was in 1950 or 1850. You can acknowledge that there's injustices and forms of discrimination today without drawing the absolute absurd inference that America is as racist as it was in the age of Jim Crow or in the age of slavery. And that makes me optimistic that, that societies that embrace the values that I hold dear do better than any other society in other parts of the world or in other historical epochs today. And that despite all of the genuine challenges in our societies, we've made genuine progress on important issues. And we are actually doing pretty well.
One difference between Sweden and the United States, and also Great Britain and basically the whole English-speaking world, is that young people in Sweden are not generally left-leaning. I mean, my generation was much more left-wing, I would say. I was born in 1982, and when my age cohort voted for the first time in 2002, I think the Green Party and the Left Party, the old Communist Party, they together had close to half of the vote of first-time voters, and they were much, much smaller in the general population, of course. But the largest parties today among young people is the moderate party. That's the largest party. Actually, it's not the Sweden Democrats. And the moderate party is liberal conservative, center-right. And, I mean, the TikTok generation or Gen Z or whatever you might call them are very woke and very left-wing in the English-speaking world. But it does not apply to Sweden, it seems like. So I wanted to ask you, is what you call the identity synthesis, and especially among young people, the popularity of it among young people, something that's happening all over the Western world, or is it mainly a phenomenon in the English-speaking countries?
So yes, I don't think that Sweden is the outlier here. I think in some ways the United States and Britain are the outlier. In Germany, for example, at the last election, young voters preferred smaller parties over larger parties. So they preferred both the Greens within the left political spectrum over the Social Democrats, which has a much older voting profile. And in the center-right coalition, they preferred the Liberals, the FDP, over the Christian Democrats. So there's certainly a difference in who they support. But young voters were actually a smidgen to the right of older voters. They certainly were not significantly more left-wing than older voters. Now, in the United States, a lot of the reason why younger voters skewed more left-wing was that there was a clear racial polarization of the American electorate, in which white voters tended to support the Republican Party and non-white voters tended to support the Democratic Party. And the proportions of those voter groups were different. So younger people are just less white than older groups. But that is starting to change, because the idea that white people are always going to vote for Republicans and non-white people are always going to vote for the Democrats is coming up against its limits. You know, Joe Biden has significantly more support among white voters today than Hillary Clinton did in 2016. And Donald Trump, according to the latest polls, has vastly more support among non-white voters today than he did in 2016. A plurality of Hispanics are now likely to vote for Donald Trump, not for Joe Biden. And that, I think, is also going to transform the extent of the youth divergence in the vote. Already in 2024, I think young people are going to skew less Democratic than they did in 2020. You know, I think the left has always been naive to think young people are going to be our salvation. It is often, you know, there is also, by the way, a generational effect. So it is often true that people are just more left-wing at 20 than they are at 50 or 80. That is true in many political contexts much of the time. But then people become more conservative as they age. And so, you know, a lot of the left has always thought the youth is our future because the youth is more left-wing. And yet somehow the left hasn't consistently dominated European politics for the last 50 years. In some contexts, young people are going to skew more left. In some contexts, they're going to skew less left. Probably by and large, young people are going to continue to be a little bit more left-wing than older people. But that doesn't mean that there is a systematic movement towards the political left, because you also have to take into account how people grow more conservative as they age. And certainly there's some political contexts in which young people actually skew to the right already today. So yes, I think here sort of a view based very much on specific American factors or specific British factors, where the conservatives have just been in power for a really long time now, which explains why a lot of 20, 25-year-olds say, look, enough, I want something new, I want something different. I think have led international observers to over-index on those particular political contexts and assume that this is all going to change. And the same is true, of course, when you think about who's actually woke. I mean, the thing that most annoys me in descriptions of his ideology is that it's often treated in the mainstream as a kind of organic, natural set of political wishes or expressions of non-white voters, right? Like, why is wokeness powerful or influential? Well, because, you know, immigrants and black people and Latinos and so on, you know, they're all woke because they reject white norms of universalism and so on, right? The sociological evidence very clearly contradicts that. So in the United States, for example, when more in common, did a study of the different kind of political tribes in the US. The tribe, what we call progressive activists, which is broadly speaking people who we might call woke, is one of the whitest tribes. It is one of the most affluent tribes and is the most highly educated tribe. So this is a predominantly white social elite, and it's them who actually embrace those ideas.
Yeah, I just want to wrap up with one last question, because I know you have a lunch to go to. And I listened to your debate with Christopher Rufo at Honestly by Barry Weiss, and it was a tripartite conversation, but it was basically a debate between you and Chris Rufo. And of course, Chris Rufo has recently come out with a book on the same subject as The Identity Trap. So there is some overlap between you. But he's also an activist who works closely with parent groups, politicians, and perhaps most famously Ron DeSantis in Florida. And I mean, I thought it was a good spirited debate on Honestly. But if he represents one of the most influential criticisms from the right, you do it from the left. So I wanted to ask you to lay out your critique of Rufo's strategy and what he's arguing for.
Yeah, so we have some intellectual disagreements about the origin of his ideology. For example, he thinks it's a form of cultural Marxism. I think that saying you can take culture, you can take economic categories like social class out of Marxism and stuff in these different cultural categories is a little bit like saying you can take goals out of football and still have a coherent activity. So I tell a very different intellectual story in my book. But I think the real disagreement we have is about how to respond to the rise of this ideology. Chris Rufo has been very effective in passing legislation, especially at the state level, in response to it. But some of it, I fear, is simply replacing one orthodoxy with another orthodoxy. So, for example, I teach a college class where students debate about many issues like cultural appropriation and free speech and so on. I'm very clear about where I stand on those issues. The students know that. But I don't think it's my role in the classroom to proselytize and to make sure that they come to agree with me and to reward them for agreeing with me, right? And so I obviously assign readings that argue that cultural appropriation is, in fact, a problem we should be worried about, and then readings that say that it's not. And by the way, I think that's very effective because students usually come in assuming that it's a problem, and just having that debate in good faith often changes their mind. I'm surprised by how many students change their mind about this once they seriously think about it. Now, there's certainly some contexts in American universities where I would be worried about what my department chair says for teaching this class and whether they would get nervous, and that's a huge problem with the way in which many elite universities in America work at the moment. But the legislation that Christopher Rufo supported in the state of Florida says that at public universities, you're not allowed to teach certain kinds of divisive concepts like identity politics. And so I'm not sure that I would be able to teach my college class at the University of Florida, for example. And so that, I think, is just a way of responding to de facto socially enforced violations of free speech with explicit, legislatively enforced restrictions on free speech, in which ultimately it's the police that tells you what you can't do. That is not the society I want to live in. I don't want to have one set of views that you have to express, or one set of views you can't express at Harvard, and another set of views that you have to express or can't express at the University of Florida. I want both Harvard and the University of Florida to allow for genuine diversity of opinion, for genuine conversation, for genuine debate among people with different points of view. And so I worry that Christopher Rufo and the political forces that he supports have drawn the wrong lessons from problems that are real and whose analysis to some extent we share. But for me, the answer is to stand up in a coherent and consistent way for the norm of free speech, not to say we're going to do to you what you're doing to us in a different context.
Thank you, Jascha Monk, for being part of Rak Höger.
Tack så mycket.
Och stort tack till er som lyssnar. Och detta är alltså en del av en större publikation på Substack med samma namn som podden, och du hittar alltihop på www.enrakhöger.se. Och har ni några frågor eller synpunkter så tveka inte att höra av er på ivararkby@substack.com. Vi hörs om en vecka igen.